From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Sunday marks the sixth anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. Today we learn what possessed the son of one of the victims to collaborate on a book with a former white supremacist.
When we're doing this work, we want to be able to understand that transformation is the ultimate part of healing.
Then, to honor the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, a Frenchman restores a 1918 Harley-Davidson. He brings it to the U.S. and rides it to Milwaukee.
If you are in France, you see a lot of people ride Harley-Davidson. It's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture, and I think Harley-Davidson brings this American culture all over the world.
On Radio Chipstone, we meet Madison area luthier Alex Holstein and learn how he makes pieces of wood sing.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Sunday marks the sixth anniversary of the shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. The hate crime left six people dead and four others wounded, and the killer later committed suicide. Among those who died was the temple's leader, Satwant Singh Kalika.
Pardeep Singh Kalika is his son, who, like many others in the community, found himself in mourning, but also angry and frustrated. Given those feelings, you might not expect that one of the first things Kalika would do in the shooting's wake would be to seek out a former white supremacist. But that's exactly how Kalika's friendship with Arno Michaelis began.
Michaelis and Kalika have collaborated on a book called The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and a Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate. They joined me earlier this spring, and Kalika explained what went through his mind as he was about to meet Michaelis for the first time.
I was thinking, what the hell am I doing? We've corresponded before we met. As that correspondent sort of gained way into like, okay, you know what, we'll physically actually meet, that nervousness became real because like, okay, now I'm about to meet this person and not just be able to Google him or find out about what he's doing. Sort of stalking from a distance, I'm actually going to meet this person. There's always nerves with that. And those nerves were reinforced by, just what had happened to us as a community and who did the shooting. Wade Page was an affiliated white supremacist that belonged to the same organization that Arnold helped found back in the day. And just knowing that that was the way that it was, people were telling me, you know, are you sure you're okay? You sure you want to do this? Or are you just, some people would flat out just tell me, you're crazy for doing this. And so just getting through my own reservations and reservations of family, friends, and things like that was quite a challenge before meeting Arno.
And how about you, Arno? What was going through your head?
I was challenged as well, kind of from a different perspective. As Parr said, the shooter was from the gang that I had helped to start. And I felt a huge degree of responsibility for what happened. I felt like I had set the stage that produced this mass murderer. And it was a very serious responsibility for me to be accountable for it and to offer myself to Pardeep and his family and his community to heal in any way I can help. At the same time, like, I didn't know what to say. Hey, I'm Arno. Sorry about your dad. There's just nothing that would have seemed sufficient. And on top of that, just from my own vanity, the restaurant I invited Parr to have dinner with me with, Isan, Tai Lao, and Farwell, is like my place. I've been known to eat there 5 days a week. I know the owners, I know the chefs, I know the servers. And I was very concerned about going to pieces when I met Parr, as I have a tendency to do. I'm a big teddy bear, actually, and tears flow when they feel like flowing. And so I'm like, I'm just going to lose it at my place in front of all my people when I meet this guy, and it's going to be really ugly. And I found that intimidating. It's an intimidating prospect for anyone to show their vulnerabilities and to express themselves like that. And so for those reasons, I had a lot of trepidation as well.
Yeah, Pardeep, your family especially was very questioning of why you'd want to go meet Arno, especially after the shooting at the Sikh temple. But what do you keep in mind now after the fact, and you guys have formed a deep bond and kind of had, you know, your collision of two worlds and have since created a new one for yourselves. What do you tell people who may doubt Arno's genuine intent and of the relationship the two of you have formed now?
That's a great question. And, you know, first off, I tell them that they're fair to have reservations about Arno's change. And I think Arno makes it plain and clear that they're also okay to have those feelings. But then, you know, when we're doing this work, we want to be able to understand that transformation is the ultimate part of healing. It is that, you know, and especially like with the situation that with this incident itself, a white supremacist hell-bent on hate came into the Sikh temple and murdered six people who he felt like weren't allowed to be not only in America, but on the face of the planet. And that kind of hate, how do you respond to it? And you have to transform that. And that's active work. That's not, you know, yes, over time we heal, but we really can, like, that's not a guarantee. And we can heal really in ways that are very self-destructive and toxic. And so they kind of understood what I was doing. I think they understood the spirit of what I was doing. And for me, there wasn't anything like uniquely special about who I am and who I was. I think it's just I felt that same weight of responsibility to respond just as Arno responded.
There's this whole theme of making sense of senselessness. Mm-hmm. When you first wanted to meet Arno, to try and understand the motivational factors in Wade Michael Page and other people like him, do you think it ever gets easier? I mean, every year there's an anniversary, but then it seems like every week, every month, there's a new shooting, there's a new hate crime, there's something else. So how do you guys continue the relentless optimism?
Yeah. I think we take a lot of inspiration from those that we work with, and this has been like students, teachers, activists, clients of mine. During this journey, I really wanted to understand human behavior at a very deep level, and that got me into working with trauma clients. And a lot of the inspiration and strength that we muster up is through the people that we work with, which are survivors of violence all over the world and perpetrators of violence all over the world, and really exploring reconciliation and transformation through a trauma-informed lens. We're very much getting to the point where we're not looking at people and saying, what is wrong with you? We're trauma-informed, so we're asking a different question, like, what happened to you? And when you ask a question like that and frame it in that way, you almost automatically have to do something about it, whether it just be bearing witness and listening to actively saying, okay, we can do something with policy, procedure, and systemic violence that has been existing for a very long time and where we're at right now.
This book is titled The Gift of Our Wounds. And one of the things that came after the Sikh temple shooting was a mass education to people of what Sikhism is and who the people are, what their religion stands for. What other gifts came from the tragedy and now through your friendship as well?
One of the gifts that I am always just absolutely overjoyed and humbled to see is other people's healing process facilitated by our story. And in my work, since I've been doing this in 2010, just coming up on stage, spilling my guts with openness and honesty and revealing my vulnerabilities, it's a really important part of my healing process. But just about every talk I've done, and I've done hundreds of them, I've had at least one person, if not more, come up and say, hey, you've helped me get to that place of openness and honesty as well, or you've inspired me to begin that journey. And that's a gift that is just absolutely priceless. And it couldn't have come from anywhere but the wound of our respective stories personally, and honestly, the wounds that exist in our society after 500 years of white supremacy.
Yeah, and you know, Audrey, you said it right, like, before this, little was known about the Sikh community. And this is, you know, we've been here for a very long time, and I feel like, in a weird way, it was like the fifth largest religion in the world. Barely anybody knows who Sikhs are, and oftentimes are confused with Muslims. especially post 9/11, and just the, just how much that was on people's minds. But this, like the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek, now is probably the second or third most well-known gurdwara in the world, and that's saying quite a bit. It's well known what happened for Sikhs. We call it Qurbani, we call it sacrifice, martyrdom, whatever you want to call it. But really, to be able to die in a place that you helped build is really called shahidi. Like that's the way that a Sikh would want to die. And so Dad died that death. And so continuing on in that legacy, those gifts from that has been very much a spiritual journey for, I think, for both of us as brothers, friends, Arnold being my therapist, and hopefully I can help him with his stuff. But it's been a very spiritual journey, and we don't know why things happened why they happened to us. And I thought about the story of the Waffle House shooting and the hero that came from that and basically stopped the gunman. And after that, after he stopped the gunman, you know, there's a story that came out that basically said he, you know, wanted to count the eyelashes on his daughter. And that gift of just presence and mindfulness and like that would not happen without suffering. And that's it's horrible that that has to be that way, because I don't think it has to be that way for everybody. I think you can really truly treasure life without having that amount of suffering. But that's the biggest gift that came out of this, is that I genuinely, and I think we both genuinely treasure life like that, that that's like everything is just completely mindful of like how much joy brings us and reminding us to be very authentic.
One thing that is constantly on our radar right now is mass shooting preventions, or the occurrence of mass shootings, gun violence. And Pardeep, you have a unique and encompassing view of gun violence. You know, first you were a police officer, so you dealt with that, both in being trained in using a gun and also dealing with gun violence in Milwaukee. You know, former high school teacher, your trauma therapy that you do now, and having lost your father to gun violence. So between your experiences and what you talk about, what do you think needs to change, or what needs to change in the narrative or in people's outlooks? What do you guys talk about when it comes to mass shooting prevention?
The biggest thing that needs to change is obviously there's all kinds of factors. And when we look at some of these issues politically, we have siloed conversations around, like, is it guns? Is it mental health? Is it, you know, school safety? What is it? And once it's like, let's get used to saying it's all of those things. And these multi-symptom problems need multi-symptom solutions. And that takes everybody, whatever you're doing in your respective fields, to come together and say, okay, I can do this. And really raising your hand when it's time to say, okay, who's going to be accountable? And I think there's a lack of that in our culture right now, is that we're passing the buck onto the next person and saying, well, that person didn't do their job and this person didn't do their job. And that happens quite a bit in mass shooting scenarios. There's a brilliant method that is used overseas called the Aarhus method. That would be a perfect example of what we can utilize here. But it would require that community is working with law enforcement and law enforcement is working with community. And we have this synergistic relationship.
We got to get over this disconnect and understand that we are all in this together. And we absolutely need a holistic approach to gun violence. We need to say those words, gun violence. At the same time, we do need to say mental health. We do need to say parenting, bullying. All these issues all fall into place. And I think that's what we need to do before we can really take firearms seriously in this country, which I don't think we do right now.
Pardeep, you mentioned in the book that Arno represents what is great about America. So in a time when people may not think America is so great right now, and there's so many examples of what's wrong with things, can you remind us of what is great and how Arno brought that thought to your brain, and then to turn around on Arno of what Pardeep represents?
Yeah, I you know, for Arno's journey, where he was born in Wisconsin, Mequon, and growing up here, and getting into the ideology and the you know, the extremist organization that he was involved in, and really taking a look at himself and reflecting, I think that's the greatest thing about America, is that it has the ability to change and to transform. You know, we often jokingly say that we absolutely believe that there's no absolutes. One of the absolutes is change. You know, I would love to say that I'm going to look this pretty and this handsome for the rest of my life, but the likelihood is probably not. You know, I'm going to change. The society is going to change. I think America represents that better than any other country, is that we understand and we have to acknowledge our history. We have to be truthful with it. We have to be honest with it. And that's that healing journey. You know, I can tell you this, like, once a person passes, you only remember the good things about that person, right? Because there's no use to remembering, like, the bad things. And that's kind of the way that we're built, is that once that suffering's passed, you kind of remember the good things about that. And, you know, for all in all, I think that we're at a really good place.
After August 5th, like the week after for me was a blur, as it was for Party. But I was doing a ton of media. It was just like I could barely keep up with everything that was happening. And as I was talking about my past, I was in awe of what the Sikh community demonstrated. Like the relentless optimism of Charikala, the forgiveness. This radical responsibility of, rather than saying, no, this is so-and-so's fault and it's racism's fault and guns' fault, almost every person from the Sikh community after the shooting was like, hey, what can we do better? How can we let the community know what Sikhism's all about better? And it just absolutely blew my mind. That combined with getting to know Party, and knowing other – being just blessed to know so many other, like, fresh immigrants to this country – I can say beyond a shadow of a doubt, I've never met anybody who loves this country more than Pardeep's family. So for people who want to make America great and they feel patriotic, like, there ain't nobody more patriotic than people who have come here and were given opportunities that they couldn't have had elsewhere. So if somebody loves the United States, they should absolutely love immigrants, because that's what makes this country great.
Well, Arno and Pardeep, I want to thank you both for coming in today, sharing your stories, and sharing the gift of our wounds.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you, Audrey.
Arno Michaelis and Pardeep Singh Kalika are the authors of The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and a Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate. Sunday is the 6th anniversary of the mass shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek.
A quick break now, and then we'll meet a Frenchman who is writing a piece of American history around the country this summer. We'll learn more when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The summer road trip is an important part of the American ethos. It's a key part of American movies, from Easy Rider to National Lampoon's Vacation. And many of us have memories of our own road trips when we were kids.
While Europeans don't necessarily pack up the car and drive across France or Italy or Poland, many do dream of their own great American road trip. And Frenchman Christophe de Goulain found the perfect vehicle to make that dream a reality. De Goulain and his friend Pierre Lavergayat restored a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle that they found in France, and they brought it to the United States for a months-long road trip to commemorate the end of World War I.
Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke met up with de Goulain at the Harley-Davidson Museum recently, and he shared the journey of the motorcycle and its sidecar.
Well, it's an incredible story, because this bike is 100 years old. This bike arrived in France in 1918 with an American soldier to liberate France and Europe. It has just spent 100 years in France, and for the first time, she's back in America, so it's her birthday. It's a very special day, especially being here in Milwaukee.
Do you have a general idea of where it spent the last 100 years since the end of World War I?
We do not know exactly where. I know I found it. It was a barn find 10 years ago. It was a fantastic day for me, the day I found her, but she was in a very poor condition. It needed 9 months' work to put it all together and make it safe to ride. And that's my friend Pierre Lauvergeat, who did all that job, and we are together touring around America.
You said it took quite a lot of work to get it into this condition. Had he or you ever done quite this extensive an amount of work on a motorcycle before?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to ride a vintage motorcycle, you need to know what's going on inside. They do break down, but they never let you on the side of the road for a long time. We had a lot of little breakdown all the way coming from Mobile, Alabama. Every time we could repair on the side of the road, or we had the help from Harley-Davidson people, the dealer, especially the one from Jacksonville, who have been helpful, and we stayed there 8 days.
I imagine Harley-Davidson was excited to hear about this project.
Yes, well, very much. I mean, Harley-Davidson is a huge company, motorcycle all around the world, people with this passion. And straight away, when we had contact with the Harley-Davidson Museum, they said, well, what a fantastic thing. Will you be coming? Yes, we will be coming with the bike. Will it be on the road? Yes, we will ride the bike to Milwaukee.
The end of World War I was 100 years ago, and I think people in the United States know about World War I, but they probably don't appreciate just how alive that history still is in France. This is something that is everywhere you go in France.
Of course. I mean, the First World War is a human disaster. The end of this disaster is with the help of America. You have in France a lot of towns, cities, village where you have got American cemetery. We call this bike Bonnie. That's the name of a village where 1844 American soldier died. And it's a very, very strong emotion because when you see the dates on the white marble cross, you know, American soldier were young. They died for the freedom of a country which was not their country. So we have to respect that and never forget. So Bonnie is there to remember. And there is a lot of people who don't know about First World War and don't know about Second World War, but America was there to help us. And thank you, America.
Have you been getting a lot of questions about this bike as you've ridden it around the United States?
Well, it's incredible. If we stop in the middle of nowhere, 5 minutes later, someone stops. First, they say, do you need some help? Well, I appreciate that because it's not in every country. And then after they have the story and they think, well, it's incredible. And we are very, very proud as French Harley-Davidson fanatic to be riding this Harley-Davidson. It's just a dream. It's a lifetime road trip. We are now after a month's trip. We have another 2 months trip and we are going to California. It's a dream. I mean, we will never forget what's happening now in America.
Do you have a newer Harley-Davidson at home in France?
I've got two other Harley-Davidson, which are 1927 and 1929. But since I'm here, yes, I want to buy a brand new Harley-Davidson. I saw them. I've been riding them. They have got the same passion. Harley-Davidson stays Harley-Davidson, even if it's 115 years. It's incredible. I love Harley.
What is it that you know, Harley is an iconic American brand. What is it that, as a Frenchman, appealed so strongly to you about Harley-Davidson?
Well, if you are in France, you see a lot of people ride Harley-Davidson. That's like in all over the world. So it's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture. And I think Harley-Davidson brings this American culture all over the world. So we heard a lot of things about tax and things like that. So please, Harley-Davidson, please, Europe, don't put any tax on Harley-Davidson. We need them for happiness.
What was the process to get this bike to the United States from France? You can't just bring it on an airplane, I imagine.
No, that was very complicated. Repairing the Harley was complicated, but bringing it to America was complicated. We had the help from the Propeller Club, which are all over the world, in the Sea World. We had then after the Airbus company, which allowed the bike to be in a ship between France and Mobile, Alabama. Then we had question of insurance, have it legal. We did all that, so it's possible. It's not easy, but I mean for Bonnie, it was important to do it. So there's no problem.
Were there any special permits that you had to obtain to be able to drive this on American roads?
It's an American motorcycle, so it was born in America, so it's absolutely legal in America. Just the insurance, which is very important. We had one company who did it.
It does not look very comfortable.
Yeah, well, it's not very comfortable, but you forget that by the pleasure of riding it. So, and we are also two riders, Pierre and I. The sidecar is very comfortable. You don't care, you know. It's you cruise along, you know, small roads. You have a break. When you're tired, you know, or you just stop and you talk with people, and it's fine like this.
The idea of the road trip is a very important one to many Americans. Do French people have the same love for getting out on the open road?
Oh yes. I mean, especially for bikers, you know, or any biker likes to jump on his bike and go for a trip. It's the same.
I have to ask, as I look at all of these other bikes, almost all of them have windshields. What is it like? How do you protect your face when you're spending that long a stretch on the road and you have nothing in front of your face?
Well, we have got the helmet, of course, but the speed, the usual speed of our motorcycle is 45 miles an hour. So the wind is just, there's no problem with the wind.
I feel like I should have you give me a tour of the bike, actually.
The bike is absolutely original. It had some paint put back on it. But here, if you see the saddle, the leather saddle, it's 100 years old. So we know that the American soldier sat on this saddle. Piston, cylinder, all the metalwork, the wheels, the spoke, the sidecar. This is all original, made in Milwaukee by Harley Davidson. It's great. We have got a modern light here because we need the good efficient light in the night. And this is the only thing which is different. And we have got the two flags here in the front on the mudguard, flag of France and America. Here we have got, this is very important for us also, because we have the United States World War I Centennial Commission, who gave us all their help, their enthusiasm, and which are following us. We have got also the Mission Centenaire, which is for France. We have, of course, the
two spare tires,
this to cover the sidecar. This is very French. On the sidecar mudguards, we have the joueur de pétanque. So you can't see it on the radio, yeah. But the people who know what pétanque is in France will recognize that. Here we have got Daffy, our sponsor. We have got stickers. And of course, we have got the Harley Davidson. Wherever we stop in a Harley-Davidson dealer, they give us a sticker and we put it on the sidecar, and we are very proud to tour then after with the sticker.
What has been the most memorable part of the trip so far for you?
I think arriving here in Milwaukee. I mean, we just arrived a quarter of an hour ago to see the Harley-Davidson Museum in front of me on the bike with Pierre. I mean, this is... that was the dream, so we are very, very happy.
Is it a little like a pilgrimage?
Yes. No, it's, I mean, there's no word to say it. I would be able to talk about this in French for hours. In English, maybe it's more difficult, but it's a very, very strong emotion.
Joie de vivre, mate.
Joie de vivre.
Well, merci beaucoup. Bon voyage.
Merci beaucoup et à bientôt. Et suivez-nous sur Twin Links so you can follow our trip on our Facebook page, which is called Twin Links.
Merci.
Merci.
Frenchman Christophe de Goulain is driving a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle around the United States to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. We spoke with him at the Harley-Davidson Museum last week.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone introduces us to Madison area luthier Alex Holstein. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Alex Holstein is a man of many titles. Husband, father, musician, carpenter, and luthier. The last one is a maker of stringed instruments like lutes, guitars, and mandolins. Holstein says he's been playing music a lot longer than he's been making guitars, but was always interested in how the instruments were constructed.
The actual making started 12 years ago after he picked up a book that described how to make archtop guitars. Holstein says he's always had a love for wood and building things with his hands, and it comes naturally. And since he's a carpenter by trade, there's always plenty of wood around.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Holstein, with the voice of his young son Lars in the background, tells contributor Jennifer Fields about how he makes bits and pieces of discarded wood sing.
When I see a grain of wood, I think, you know, how can I make this talk through the instrument? How can I use this and showcase it on the instrument? I really love light instruments, so I always try and make everything as light as I can, because I think, you know, if you're comfortable, you're going to be playing better. It just feels good. I first started building arch tops. They have a carved top and back. They're associated with like jazz and country, that sort of thing. And so they're kind of like a violin in construction. You know, they got the arch top, there's stress on the top. I'd say they're, compared to a flat top, they're like a little muddier sound, a little darker sound. They're not as sweet as like a flat top sounds acoustically. And then I also build electric instruments, you know, solid body, Les Paul, Stratocaster-like instruments, you know, those types of things. So,
you're smiling as we're talking about this stuff, Alex. Talk to me about where your mind goes when you're working on one of these things. Because you're a construction worker, father. Yeah. Your kid, we can hear he loves trains.
Yeah, sure
like,
does.
Where does your head go when you're doing this?
You know, I am focused purely on what I'm doing. So it goes right to my project. You know, I don't think about anything else in life. It's just about carving wood or trying to fix a little mistake that happened along the way and how to hide anything that happens. Because when you machine stuff by hand, it's just not always perfect. And you kind of strive for perfection, but I don't even know if it's achievable on the scale that I do things, you know, mostly by hand. So yeah, it's
Does this work take you somewhere that other things don't take you?
Definitely. You know, playing music is kind of, you know, I would almost think of it religiously, where it kind of takes me to another plane and another mindset that you can't really achieve anywhere. It's hard to describe, but I think you know, working on instruments is a similar thing.
So do you actually hear the sound of the guitar before you finish it? Are you hearing things in your head, sort of hearing the music that it's going to make?
You do a lot of tap toning as you carve things. As far as the actual voice, I wish I could, you know, because that's always like one of those things when you put strings on something the first time, it is so exciting. I mean, I just, you know, I start to clench up and sweat a little bit, and it's just like one of those, I just can't wait to get it tuned up and hear what it sounds like. There's something called a node on a piece of wood. And if you squeeze a node, that's where it does not vibrate. So if you do that, you can tap it and it makes this ringing sound. So this is a piece of cherry that's, I'd say about 3/16 thick, you know, probably 8 by 20 inches long. So that was a dead spot. That was not one. There, it's somewhere in here. But you can kind of hear it ring. So as you carve things and they get thicker, or thinner, I mean, they get a lower pitch. So you're always trying to get a nice true note. You know, this one isn't like perfectly sanded or anything, so you don't get as nice of ring as you might with something else. But here, I'll grab a piece of maple. You might even be able to hear that a little better. You know, so you can hear how hot and bright that note is already. So that's a spot. I'm pinching it with two fingers and kind of holding it off my hand. And then I tap it in the center and it'll make a nice, you know, note. It's a true note. I don't have perfect pitch, so I can't tell you if that's a C sharp or an A, but it's a nice note. So, you know, that's a big part of, you kind of get to know your wood as you're working it, and you keep tapping it and hear it change, and you know, kind of get what you're going for in the sound.
Oh, this one's pretty.
Yeah, thanks. It's a flat top, you know, acoustic guitar with a Sitka spruce top and a mahogany neck, back and sides.
And the little, what are they called?
Inlays?
The inlays almost look like a Thunderbird, like that Thunderbird wing pattern.
Yeah, it's actually the symbol, the Anunnaki symbol for flight. So it's like this ancient aliens stuff that I kind of meant to. And I built this guitar for myself, so I did kind of a personal touch. My friend Missy Howard made me a belt buckle that my wife commissioned from her, and it matches the inlays, so that's my cool stage thing, you know, to have a matching belt buckle.
Nice.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that feeling of not only you playing a guitar that you've made, but seeing somebody you love play one that you've made.
It's really cool. You know, it warms my heart, and it makes me think, you know, where is this guitar going to be after I'm gone? You know, who's going to be playing this? You know, is it going to be one of my relatives, one of my friends' relatives, you know, or just somebody who I've never, couldn't even imagine? You know, it's just fun to think about that these things will outlast you and me.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jonifer spoke with Madison area luthier Alex Holstein.
We'll take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Ex Fabulo. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabulo!
True personal story.
Ex Fabulo!
Ex Fabulo is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for Ex Fabulo Radio once again, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every weekend on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter. Sitting in for Leah this week is Carlina from Ex Fabulo. Welcome back. You've done this once before.
Yes, I have. I'm happy to be here.
And we have stories this week about?
About fun on the farm.
In conjunction with State Fair, I guess. We can tie it all in.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were part of Sculpture Milwaukee, too, that the stories associated with that just ended. You were part of that, right?
Yeah, so Ex Fabulo partnered with Sculpture Milwaukee to exhibit storytelling tours for their 21-piece urban outdoor exhibit. And so I was able to assist with all of three of those and kind of document everybody who attended and all the storytelling.
That's on video and audio?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. What's our first story today? What's it about?
Our first teller is Liza Kessler, coming from the Acquired Taste Story Slam. She came on stage with a broken arm cast, and she was talking about how she needed to protect her cast while she was showering. Oddly enough, it ended with a story about cattle insemination.
Let's hear it.
Hello. So a little over a year ago, I do have a prop. I'm sorry, Megan, but I'm not taking it off. A little over a year ago, I fell down. If you were here at the Times at the last one, I told a story right after my surgery. What happened is I tore a ligament. And that it took me a while to figure it out. It took a while longer to get the right diagnosis. It took a while longer to get the surgery actually to happen. And part of the particular ligament that I tore, it's the one that controls moving your arm like this. So the recovery involves a full arm cast for 6 weeks because when you move your elbow, your wrist can go like this. So I had some concerns about how I was going to shower while in a full arm cast. Now, cast technology has improved a lot since I was a kid, but because surgery, I was not allowed to get it wet. And so I asked the surgeon, okay, so if I can't get it wet, what do I do? This being Wisconsin, he said, well, you should go up to Menards and you should get some cattle insemination gloves. Okay. But you see, cattle insemination gloves threw me instantly back into a time warp. It was 1986, and my family had just finished hosting an exchange student who was English, but her mother was German, and she spoke fluent German. My grandparents on my dad's side were German immigrants, and my family decided that we should go and meet all the relatives who hadn't immigrated. And Isabel, the exchange student, joined us for this trip. So we went off to this small town in Germany called Kleiniedersheim that, if you speak German, helps distinguish it from Groß Niedersheim down the road, Little Niedersheim versus Big Niedersheim. So there we are in Little Niedersheim with these relatives of mine who speak no English. I speak no German. So I am completely dependent on Isabel for the entire translation part of this trip. And it's a farm, and these two relatives of mine, the adult farmer and the young adult or older teenage farmer, have this bull. And their bull is a stud. And they have just been working really hard all day harvesting bull semen. So Isabel, we're 16, mind you, hears this and looks at me and shrieks, oh my God, did you hear that? And I say, yes, but I don't understand any of it. And she completely ignores it. Now, she is a person who was super curious about everything. There was no subject matter too taboo, too awkward, too embarrassing, too anything for Isabel. So she proceeds to interrogate my relatives about how you go about harvesting bull semen. And pretty much every answer that she got back, she would look at me and shriek again, oh my God, did you hear that? I think the whole thing took about 15 minutes, but I could be wrong because in the moment, it felt like I was spending all of eternity in hell. But I think that turned out to be wrong. So finally, if my translator is to be believed, I discovered that the process involved a wooden cow and a bicycle with a cooler on the back and some large syringes. I'm not really sure, but the bottom line really is that I think showering while wearing a arm-length plastic glove is probably nearly as much of an acquired taste as harvesting bull semen.
Moo, 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 I love you. I know you're a cow, but anything will do. Ooh-wee, can't you see? I just wanna make love to you.
So that was Liza Kessler's story from the Acquired Taste Story Slam.
I can relate to that because I learned how to wrap myself in saran wrap after a surgery and broken bones and trying to keep it dry in the shower. It's not easy.
I mean, I've never broken a bone, but I've gotten tattoos, so I can relate.
Yeah, I hang my leg outside the shower for a while years ago trying to keep it dry. It's very uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable.
And what's coming up with X Fabulous? Season 10 will be here before we know it.
Yes, so season 10 starts next month, early September. So we really encourage people to get their season 10 memberships, and you can get those online at xfabula.org.
All right, second story today.
Our second teller is Hannah Utenbrook. She told a story at an X Fabula fellowship event interrogating whiteness. talking about her family's ancestry and immigration from the United States, or to the United States from Prussia, and also talking about a lot of memories at her family farmhouse.
All right, let's hear it.
When I grew up, I would walk across the street with my family, and we would go to church with all 24 of my family members. And after Mass, we'd all come back and we'd all go into across the street again, because my grandma and grandpa live next to us. And we would go into their old farmhouse and we'd have homemade bread and eggs and homemade jam. And we'd just spend the day together, because why not? And after, one of the things that my grandfather loved to do was tell stories. And one of his favorite stories that he'd always tell was a story of when our first ancestor came to the United States. So his name was Joseph Eichenbrock, and the story goes, when they're coming from Prussia, and there's three boys in the boat with their mother, and they came across the United States, and there's no record of the mother actually making it to the United States. So she died on her way over. And the boys they arrived to the United States as orphans. And then they were shipped off to Wisconsin, I don't quite know why, and brought to a Catholic church. And the priest put them out in front and said, anyone want them? they're taken, Joseph was taken in by a farming family. That is the story my grandpa will tell with like gratitude and joy. Just a story that's very dear and near to my heart. Grew up, loved family gatherings at my grandparents' house. Eventually, graduated high school, made it to college. And in college, I was a sociology major. And that was the first time I started to learn concepts like white privilege and white supremacy and institutionalized racism. And those things were like so true, like yeah, that makes so much sense, of like that's the way the world is. But then I had two different stories kind of going in my head that left me very confused about what was true about the American story and what was true about like how I viewed the world. So I'd come home and I would like talk to my family members, and we'd like fight about things, and it was the first time I was like, I don't want to belong to these people. My grandpa, the stories he tells, he also tells racist stories. That's my grandfather. He loves me. He takes care of me. He tells me that I'm a good person. I was in college and I was learning about, at the same time, like all the black men were being shot by the police. And I started reflecting, like, no one would shoot me. No. No, there's no reason a police would shoot me. Like, no. At the same time, I started realizing things about my family story. I started thinking about it a little bit deeper and wondering, when Joseph Eichenbrock came to the United States as an orphan, like, why wasn't he sold into, like, child labor or some slavery or some way? Like, there's only one reason. In the farmland that my family has passed on from generations, like, that was land that the government stole from the Menominee Indians, and it now benefits my family. That's generational wealth. It feels so shameful and so also really incomplete, because I can stand here and say these things and know these things, but like, what does that mean? What does it mean to me not wanting to belong to my family members? I belong to them. They belong to me. I don't want to belong to that. I don't want to belong, I want to fix, I want to correct my family members when they may say something that may make me feel really uncomfortable because I know it's racist. But I'm part of the problem as well. If they belong to me and I belong to them, I'm part of the problem. And it's in my own heart as well. So
And that was Hannah Utenbrock, again, from the Interrogating Whiteness Exfabula Fellowship event.
And all things Exfabula, not just the story slams and season tickets, but anything you guys got coming up, is that information's at your website, right?
Yeah, if you just go on exfabula.org.
Thank you for pinch hitting today.
Of course.
Carlina in for Leah. Leah will be back next week with more stories every weekend on Lake Effect Weekend from Exfabula Radio. And if you want to hear these stories again or share them with friends, you will find them with pictures at WUWM.com.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie Moore. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.
Put them down, put them down, put them down. Be sure you put them on the ground. Watch your step, watch your step, watch your step. When you swing your partner round and round. And don't have too much to nip, or maybe you will slip. Doing the cow pasture polka.